You've got attuned to KEXP. You can find us at 90.3 FM in Seattle, streaming round the world at kexp.org. I'm Cheryl Waters, live in the studios with Johnny Marr and his fantastic band. Welcome.
It's nice to be here. Hi.
I am absolutely in love with your new album, Call the Comet. I cannot play it enough. And you're going to start off with a couple of songs from that, yeah?
Yeah, we're going to start off with a song called Bug. Should we do it now?
Absolutely.
Here we go.
Listening to Johnny Marr live in the KEXP studios playing a song from the new album Call the Comet. That sounded fantastic.
Thank you. So
great to have you here. Johnny Marr playing at the Showbox tonight here in Seattle. Tomorrow you can catch him at the Roseland in Portland, Oregon. Want to play another song?
Sure, yeah, this one's called Hi Hello.
So fast when I see you coming down that line, see the future that your mother's child, and I'll find you when you're losing your mind and you can't let go. All the places, all the steps you climb are off the beaten track. When you're falling and you keep on climbing, say no. One heartbeat, any place we run. And I see you coming down that line. See the future for tomorrow's child. And I'll find you when the lights are blinding and you can't get home. Gonna come too fast. Time is cutting us, gets in the way and fools the past. When there's nobody else around, on the train on the way from town, and you feel like you can't be found and you can't let go. All the faces taking up your time, you say tomorrow you're the future's child, and you know where to go. So hi, hello, wherever you need and wherever you go. I can't say no. Walk our street any day you want. And I see you coming down that line, on the screen.
That is Hi Hello from the new Johnny Marr album. That sounds fantastic.
Thank you.
I was lucky enough to see, well, I've seen you play a number of times, but I saw you in Seattle on your last two albums, The Messenger and Playland. And every live show that you play seems like you're just wanting it to be the best show that you ever played. You always bring so much energy to your live performance.
Well, thanks. I'm glad that comes across because that is the way I feel, really. I think, you know, when you do a show, nothing else is really going on. There's been no past, no future. You're trying to really, really be in that moment. And partly because I think it's doing shows is just such a great event. It's such a great pastime, and it's a great thing to be able to do. And I like going to shows. So I'm not casual about it. I think that's the thing. Not to say that I take it seriously, but I just think it's a great thing to be involved in, you know. So, and I happen for a living to be very fortunate that for a living I plug my guitar into a very loud bunch of speakers, and people want to listen, and it's been that way for quite a long time now. So as more time goes on, that notion is kind of precious to me, really. And then other times you just go on, you're just trying to not screw up. You know, it's not always so conceptual.
Well, we live in chaotic times, and I've heard you say before that you feel like art and music stands for hope, and that you do feel very privileged to be able to make that art and music, but you want that to come out through your music.
Yeah, I mean, I think I always did associate music with hope. It doesn't necessarily have to be political, but, you know, from being a kid going out to school or college, or you know, getting on the train going to work or whatever, it's just the music and following bands and everything just always used to sort of take me out of myself, really. And and then, as you know, I got you know, past just being into music, then all kinds of art did the same thing for me. So it's a way of kind of lifting you up, I think. So and, you know, just come back to live shows again. I mean, that's the best thing you can get from a live show, that you, this sort of feeling of being kind of lifted out of your life for an hour and a half. That's a pretty powerful thing. So, yeah, I still believe that music is about hope, yeah. And, of course, when it's more directly message-based, if it can be very, very, you know, there's specifically political or have an agenda, and there's been really, really good things done with that, you know, particularly since the post-war movement, whether it's the 60s, 70s, 80s, and current day.
It's clear that you're an unbridled fan of music, and that goes back to your childhood. You listen to a lot of music, and it sounds really creepy to know so much about someone, but I've followed a few of your bands and been a fan for a long time, and I read your autobiography, Set the Boy Free.
That's not creepy. That's nice. I wish more people knew about that stuff.
But I know how much you love music and how important you feel like that relationship is with the fan. You knew at a young age that you wanted to be in a guitar-based band, even though you listened to a lot of styles of music. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I think being a fan's a really... it's a cool thing, you know, and I don't think it's necessarily something that you need to kind of grow out of either. I try and sort of keep that flame, really, of being a fan alive. You know, in my case, excuse me, it was people like Patti Smith, really. And so that feeling of appreciation and admiration is... I know what that feels like, and I try and keep that going, you know, in myself. I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be there. But yeah, it started off as a very, very young kid, because my parents were really quite obsessive fans of music, and still are, and they bought records. So I grew up in a house of real music and record 45 freaks, you know.
Oh, lucky
and,
you.
Yeah, my parents were very young. So so that kind of stuck with me, really. And I saw that behavior from being very young. And yeah, so I grew up in a household, as I say, of real record freaks. And my parents still are, funny enough. They go out a lot and go see singer-songwriters and everything. So I don't really know any different. And I've never seen any reason to grow out of it, I don't think.
Do they get out to your shows?
Yeah, they do come out to the occasional show, yeah. Yeah.
When did you pick up the guitar, and what was that like? Because so many musicians very extremely proficient guitarists in their own right say they can't do what you do. I mean, they can watch you on stage, but they can't replicate your sound. How did you develop that?
I started off I got my first guitar when I was a little boy, and it was a toy. It was a little wooden thing, and it was my favourite toy, and I used to carry it around everywhere. I was kind of obsessed with it, and you couldn't play anything on it, but I could just carry it around, you know, like a teddy bear or something, and cuddle it, you know. And so I did that, and then I was just, I just needed one that I could learn to play on. So I think getting your own style together, I'd imagine it should be the same now. I don't see any reason why it isn't, but definitely in my generation, growing up through the mid and late 70s, it was the thing to have your own sound, have your own distinctive original sound. That was very, very important. I'd like to think it's still important for people now, but that to me was a paramount, really, and my friends too. And I grew up in an environment, the council estate that I grew up on, there was a load of guitar players, so I was very lucky that there was a lot of older guys who were real guitar aficionados. So my life was just always in the pursuit of playing the guitar. But I'm not a particularly, I don't think I'm a technical guitar player, but what I do is kind of sort of quite unique to me. So yeah, quite a few guitar players. I've heard some people sort of talk about it like it's baffling, but some of the people that I've listened to over the years, they really are baffling. So I guess it's probably like trying to replicate someone's a signature or a thumbprint or something. You get kind of close to it, but you can't really quite do it. So it's just acts a combination of a life of obsession and accidental kind of getting some things wrong and doing things your own way, taking shortcuts that end up sort of sounding clever, maybe.
You used the word lucky a minute ago, and I've heard you call yourself lucky in some interviews and writing, but you have also been clear to say that you went after your luck. And I felt that does, you know, that the specificity in that, the designation of that, was very interesting, because you can't just sit around waiting for luck. And you seem to be very inspired and driven. You've gone after your good luck.
Yeah, well, I think a bit of that, quite a lot of that, is growing up in a very working class family, to be honest. I think it's there was no question of me. I wasn't even going to go to college, really. That wasn't really on the cards for sort of my generation of working class people, really. Only a handful of people did that. I just wanted to drop out and play the guitar. But sort of driven, work ethic, I guess, luck. There is that phrase, like, the harder you work, the luckier you get. Maybe a little bit of that happened. But and to be honest, desperation, I think. Desperation to get out of my sort of... the circumstances which seemed to me to be a future of boredom in the suburbs at the very best, you know, and being skint and being broke. So a combination of all that kind of crazy, almost mystical appreciation of music, which I think is not overstating things. I'm still like that now, and I'm okay with that. I do think there's a mystical side of music, and it's a bit too late for me to change that. That crossed with coming from a working class background and being broke, it kind of gets you off the couch and knocking on people's doors and sleeping in rehearsal room floors. And you know what, as well, all of that stuff was great to me. Oh, I couldn't wait to sign up for all of that. I was fine with sleeping on couches. It sounded great.
It's worked out okay for you.
Yeah. I sleep on a bunk right now.
You certainly haven't let the grass grow under your feet, though, and you've been lucky to have a lot of people, great people, supporting you, and clearly you love to collaborate. In fact, it'd be wonderful if you introduced your band.
Sure, yeah. Me and the boys have been together now for about 7 years. Time goes by so quick. On the bass guitar is Ewan Grono. Ewan's from Cornwall, and we first worked together on the drums, Jack Mitchell, who's from Manchester. Ewan and Jack and I first worked together when these two guys were the rhythm section at a band called Haven, great band that I produced a while back. And then on guitars and keyboards is James Doviak, who co-produces the records with me. And Me and James have been working together now for about 15 years now. Don't run away, James. Don't run away. We're going to give you that news.
We don't have enough hours in a day to talk about all the people that you have worked with, Haven, Marion, you produced, yeah. Modest Mouse, Pet Shop Boys, The Pretenders. It goes on and on and on, all the bands you've been in. I do want to talk for a second about one very cool collaboration. Late last year, I saw the most amazing video. It really was like a little documentary. You worked with Maxine Peake on that, The Priest. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. That's Maxine Peake is a very revered and respected actor out of the north of England. She's been around for about 15, 20 years or so now. She's been doing the stuff, Maxine. I had this idea of doing a different kind of music that wasn't so song-based, and I just knew I wanted to play guitar and get away from regular kind of songs. And I had this idea of spoken word over the top of it. And the very first sort of idea I had was Maxine, because who I didn't know then, but I was a fan of. And she's amazing. And anyway, her and I got together and we got along, and then I started writing some music with James, and Maxine would provide some text and document, spoken word on top of it. And anyway, The Priest came about because of a blog that was written by a writer who had found himself on the streets for quite a while. And he'd written this, a story of his experiences being homeless. And Maxine was inspired to arrange it and then gave it me as a spoken word. And then I put the music behind it. And it was great. It was a tremendous thing. It was like really inspired. There's other things that I've done with Maxine that hopefully we've got to finish when we get the time. She's always working on films. And, you know, me and the boys have been making this record. So hopefully we'll get a chance to finish the thing with Maxine. But if people go on YouTube and they look for Johnny Marr and Maxine Peake, The Priest, they'll see this cool little film we made with this, also a young up-and-coming actress called Molly Windsor, who's recently just won a BAFTA for Young Actress, Best Young Actress. And Molly plays the part of this person out on the street to mine and Maxine's track. And it's pretty interesting. It's kind of an interesting sort of slant on what it's like living on the street. It's not what you would think it would be. So that was really inspiring. And it's nice that you mentioned it, because I wasn't sure whether people were as aware of it in the United States as they are in the UK, because it kind of went under the radar a little bit. So it's nice to be able to talk about it.
It is really quite amazing, and Molly really is outstanding.
Yeah, Molly's amazing. She's 20, 21, but as I say, she won a BAFTA for a very, very challenging and impressive role in a TV series called Three Girls, which is a true, very harrowing sort of story. So we're very, very lucky. That was kind of top of my wish list, was to work with Maxine, and that happened. And then when we did the track, I had this idea of working with Molly, and then she was up for it. So luckily the work's good enough for people to want to work on it. You know, it's not just, you have to actually do something cool for people to want to do it. So that's when you have to roll your sleeves up and do something good. But the track's cool.
Well, speaking of cool, Call the Comet, which is what you're here today playing and talking about, is so wonderful. And I know your second record was actually written while you were touring on the first record. So that was kind of a whirlwind. A few more years went by. Obviously, it sounds like you've been really busy, but you've said that this record's a little bit more dramatic, a little bit more emotional. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, that's right. Well, 2014, we put Playland out, and then we were touring, because it's really important to us, all four of us, that we're a live band. And it was always the intention to write Playland on the road. So anyway, we were touring that, and then I wrote a book in 2016, and then me and the fellas did the album in 2017. That brought us up to, that's why there was the gap between Playland and this one. But to answer your question, I went in there with the writing of the record, with James co-producing, with no real agenda of what we were going to do, and no agenda. I just wanted to follow my feelings, really. And the world had changed quite a lot in the last couple of years. Both our countries, there'd been a lot of upheaval and change. And I found that I was just kind of emotionally trying to escape in a way, really, just as a person, doing what I used to do when I was 15, which was write tracks to escape the outside world. And, I think that's why it's more dramatic. So in other words, the first two albums, I had a very strong feeling that the songs should be really all punchy and quite short and sort of kind of new wavy, you know, so that we could really play these really upbeat live shows. And because we called the comic, because I was just going in with blank piece of paper, nothing on tape. Oh, we had one song, Spiral Cities, which is in itself is quite dramatic. But I was kind of feeling, you know, I guess I was feeling emotional and a bit dramatic, I suppose, because about halfway through the record, I realised that, you know, the songs were sounding like that. And so it turned out by just following your instincts and not having a plan that the record is different from the others. And it's you know, seems to be quite popular. And I think when you do something that's got emotion in it, I'm very proud of the first two records. There's some great songs on it, but I think people react to emotional content. They can feel it. They can hear it in the melodies and in some of the words. And that song we just did, Hi Hello, maybe that wouldn't have made it on the first two records because it's very personal, you know. It's very about unconditional love, you know. But and I would have perhaps censored that on the first two records because I wanted to just not avoid singing about myself. But the more emotional bits on the record seems to be quite popular. So I might have to do more of that. Singing about me.
Just keep doing more. That's sure, all we want. You. We're live here in the KEXP studios with Johnny Marr. Call the Comet is the brand new record. They're playing tonight at the Showbox here in Seattle. They've been so kind to come into the KEXP studios today, and they're going to play a couple more songs.
Okay. This is one that people might recognize.
Jealous
jokes in 1982. He does the military to his dead dog. Kicks me in the showers, kicks me in the showers, and he grabs and devours. I wanna go home. I don't wanna stay there.
Johnny Marr live on KEXP. It's incredible to think that an album and songs written over 35 years ago have such staying power. And probably when you were in your 20s, I want to say you didn't know that you were going to be in this band for less than a decade that would go on to have legendary status and be beloved for decades. But when you talk about, you know, when I read your book, you're like, it sounds like every band in Manchester feels like they're going to attain legendary status. You sounded like you signed up from the get-go, but, you know, you're so down to earth. It's just, I mean,
well,
I can't imagine what it feels like to be so beloved.
Well, I don't really know how to answer that one, to be honest with you. I think the bit about people in Manchester, the culture that I came out of with the Smiths was a very, for a bunch of reasons that it's too long to go into, but it was a very inspired kind of culture. There was Factory Records was in town, so all the bands that people kind of know about, New Order and Certain Ratio, Joy Division, etc., The Fall, blah, blah, you know. That was all, everyone was living, you know, around the block from each other. Everyone's rehearsing in the same rehearsal rooms. And so I guess there was a sort of aspiration in a way, you know, the bar was kind of high in terms of aspiration. I don't mean in terms of making a load of dough and being big, although when that became a prospect, then everyone just went for it. I mean, of course, you know, I mean, I'm thinking like New Order became a very big band and the Smiths became a very big band. But when we first started out, all those bands I mentioned, we were just, I guess, trying to be a relevant, we're all trying to be relevant, what I would say, street bands, you know, after the punk movement. We were trying to do cool stuff that actually wasn't commercial. The commercial thing, everybody learned to write songs. Joy Division learned to write something like Love Will Tear Us Apart. The Smiths learned to write What Difference Does It Make? And, you know, then you had Happy Mondays and The Roses and Oasis and all of that stuff that's been written about loads. The culture we came out of was actually perversely uncommercial, and there's something very powerful in that. I think the bands who, you can tell the bands who are into it for something, let's put it this way, you can tell the bands who are into it just to be commercial. Fine, there's nothing, you know, whatever floats your boat, that's fine. But the bands that all the people I mentioned, you know, we did revere the Velvet Underground, and we revered Brian Eno and those kind of people. So it was a great, I'm getting very, very nostalgic now. You shouldn't have started me.
I'm feeling nostalgic right along with you. Of course, I love all those bands as well. But I mean, there is something you spoke about, trusting your gut, and you were just playing music that you love, maybe wanting to impress your friends.
Yeah.
get people out to shows.
I think that's a great, most musicians, certainly, maybe other artists, don't know about actors or comedians, I'd say, they just want to impress their friends, really. The trick is making sure you've got some pretty discerning friends, really, I guess. But yeah, first and foremost, you want your mates to think that your band is cooler than the band that they just saw from London the night before, I think.
Well, you got all that one-upmanship and then you end up with that incredible, rich music scene.
Yeah, yeah.
It must have been insanely wonderful to be a part of that.
Yeah, well, you do have to get down to actually writing the music at some point, though.
Yes, then there's that.
You know, so, and again, you know, all the bands that are revered, they all got in and worked pretty hard, you know, because I know we all know each other, all those guys. We do, you know. I get asked that, and you know, the Mondays and the Roses and everybody. Yeah, we all knew each other, and everyone just locked themselves away in a rehearsal room, but and really slugged it out and learned to do stuff the hard way. But and partly the reason for that, I've been asked for 30 odd years why that it is because we come from a very rainy city.
As we do here in Seattle.
I know that, yes. And
you asked me earlier if I grew up here, and most of my life, yeah.
That's a big part of it. And when I first started coming to the United States, when I first visited Seattle, it did remind me of Manchester. And I lived in Portland, Oregon, when I joined Modest Mouse in 2005 for quite a number of years, well, for 4 years or so. So I was up and down the coast there. And I still haven't changed that opinion, really, that Manchester, the relationship between Portland and Seattle is quite like the relationship between Sheffield and Manchester, similar kind of vibe.
Did you enjoy your time in Portland?
Yeah, I loved it. It was great, yeah. We're going there tomorrow, so I'm going to look up some friends and check out the food trucks.
I know you're a huge soccer fan, football for you. Oh, we have a huge rivalry with the Timbers. We're very proud of our Seattle team, the Sounders.
I know that.
Please don't tell me you were rooting for the Timbers when you were living in Portland.
Oh, I'm going to have to put my guitar down now. Listen, I'm going to Portland tomorrow, so I can't answer that.
We do have Portland listeners. All right, I won't put you on the spot there. We're live here in the KEXP studios. Johnny Marr and his fabulous band are playing at the Showbox tonight, and they have one more song to share with us.
Thank you. This is off the album Playland. This is called Easy Money.
That's funny money. just slave. No rainy day, better come this way. It's only money, that's easy money, that's easy money.
Johnny Marr, live here in the KEXP studios, playing tonight at the Showbox here in Seattle. Call the Comet, great new album. So great to have you here.
Thank you all so much. Thanks for having us.
You've got it tuned to KEXP Seattle.